Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With $4 plus a gallon gas, a floundering economy, and an ocean of unsold SUVs, the big three American auto companies are really struggling. This week, Ford is announcing big changes, moving away from big pickups and SUVs, converting truck assembly plants to make more small, fuel-efficient cars. GM is talking about electric cars and plugging into the grid. But meanwhile, they're hemorrhaging. Are these changes too late? This hour on Point, we're talking about the U.S. auto industry in crisis and how, if, it can be saved. Joining me first today from Detroit is Bill Vlasic. He's Detroit Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and he's been following the unfolding crisis there. Bill, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me on, Tom.
First, the numbers. I mean, how badly is Ford up against it here? You're reporting, they are reporting, in 2006 and 7, they lost $15.3 billion. Any sign of a turnaround on that?
Well, it's been a very, very difficult couple of years here in Detroit for Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler. And Ford's going to announce another quarterly loss tomorrow. And it doesn't look like the market, which is way down for vehicle sales, is going to change anytime soon. So there's some tough times ahead. But Ford is also going to announce some very dramatic actions tomorrow to change its focus down. Size its truck and SUV production, which was so profitable in the 1990s, but has really fallen off a cliff with high gas prices, and move to more small cars, European-styled cars, smaller engines, and the kind of vehicles that consumers seem to want today.
The stakes just as high as they could be. You quote members of the top management team there, quoting Alan Mulally, the CEO at Ford, saying, "We don't have a sustainable company if we don't do this." But what he's prescribing is a huge overhaul. Give us the sense of the scale of it, Bill, and whether it can actually be done, be pulled off.
Well, it is a huge overhaul, and it's probably should have been done some time ago or in increments. But sometimes things don't work that way, and it has to really get difficult before they make changes. This is very expensive and very challenging. Ford is, our understanding, going to convert three of its massive assembly plants in North America, three of the eight that make truck products, to cars, and do it in a fairly short period of time. Our understanding is in less than 2 years. That alone is a very big task. But on top of that, they're going to bring these European cars that are being designed as we speak to America to be built here and sold here, and that is a challenge as well, because while the cars do look like they may be the popular vehicles in this country, there's changes that have to be made. There's tooling and production and design and marketing and all this.
Yeah, and these are Ford's European cars, the small fuel-efficient ones that they've been selling over there and building over there, but not building and selling here.
No, and it's one of the things. Mulally is a newcomer to Detroit. He was hired 2 years ago after 30-some years with Boeing, the aircraft company. And he immediately kind of latched on to why is everything different in Europe than in the U.S.? And one of his big challenges over these last 18 to 20 months has been to globalize the organization as well as the products.
So, for example, they're going to take the so-called Michigan truck plant in Wayne, Michigan. It builds Ford Expeditions and Lincoln Navigators right now. They're going to flip that. That will make what?
Well, the plan, as I understand, is that's going to be making the Ford Focus, which is about as
teeny tiny little gas-sipping car.
Yeah, it's about as big a change as you could attempt. But these are desperate times for Ford and for General Motors, and definitely for Chrysler, which is now privately held, and we don't even know how much red ink is flowing over there.
We've been talking about Ford, but at GM, I mean, they're already talking about slashing jobs, cutting production, selling assets, suspending its dividend for the first time in 86 years, trying to ride out this almost collapse in the U.S. market. Ford led the way on bringing SUV and pickup truck sales front and center. There was a time when Ford and other automakers, you report, earned up to $15,000 in profit on each full-size sport utility vehicle. Can they make anything like that on these smaller cars? And if they can't, how do the numbers add up?
Well, they don't make anything like that in smaller cars. That Michigan truck plant at one point was considered the single most profitable auto plant in the world, somewhere generating $2 billion in profits just out of that plant. When everybody wanted a Navigator, the bling-bling big SUV of the era, no, they can't make those kind of profits on small cars. But what they can do is spread the cost of development and building these cars across Europe, across the U.S., and eventually Asia, too. So get some savings and make it more a better business case for them. And if they build them better and in a European style with the kind of options that Americans love, they can make some incremental profits and, if nothing else, stop the bleeding and get a new start.
GM talking this week about cooperating with electric grid operators for an electric car coming down the pike, but nobody sees that coming soon. And we're reading reports that industry watchers were alarmed recently when GM CEO Rick Wagoner had to insist that the company was not considering bankruptcy. When you have to insist you're not talking about it, everybody starts talking about it.
Well, GM's stock went into a free fall about 2 weeks ago when a prominent auto analyst suggested that bankruptcy was not impossible, primarily because GM is as truck-dependent as Ford, and as these trucks have, as the market has dried up so dramatically, they're burning through their cash reserves. And the worry was that General Motors wouldn't have enough of a so-called cash cushion to ride out this this very difficult market. Now, General Motors, I don't believe, has considered bankruptcy. I don't think their management team would do that. I think they'd leave before they'd do that. But that's beside the point. The liquidity, the cash is just these numbers are kind of staggering. That GM is spending $1 billion more a month than they're taking in. But they announced some fairly large cost-saving measures last week, including cutting 20% of their white-collar costs in U.S. and Canada, cutting all retiree health care for salaried employees after the age of 65,
wow,
and suspending the dividend. So it's kind of like, you're throwing everything overboard to keep the boat floating.
Yeah, and we'll see if it does. Bill Vlasic, Detroit Bureau Chief of the New York Times, thanks for your reporting and your time today, Bill.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Joining me now from San Jose, California, is Walter McManus. He's Director of Automotive Analysis at the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute, former Executive Director of Forecasting Analysis with J.D. Power & Associates, also a former marketer for General Motors. Walter McManus, welcome back to One Point. Good to have you.
Well, thank you, Tom.
And with us from Lexington, Virginia, is journalist, author, and auto analyst David McGee. He appears frequently on Fox News. He's author of How Toyota Became Number One and Turnaround. David McGee, welcome to you.
Thank you.
How much trouble are these companies looking at right now, David?
Hey, they're looking at a lot of trouble. They've been in trouble for a long time, and there's been a long-running state of denial. Those of us who followed it feel like Ford has been struggling, certainly, but they've been for a number of years now in much more forthright acknowledging position of the difficulty they were in. General Motors held for a long time a significant state of denial, and people were kind of secretly whispering behind their back, what are they thinking? They're in a tough spot. I mean, we are in a nobody's using the term bubble for the car market, and like they did for the housing market, and I'm waiting for them to use it because we are in a classic car market bubble that the automakers falsely propped up sales for a number of years, and by the way, they still lost money. So you can imagine now with the demand falling off the table, the bubble is completely ruptured, and they're in a hard spot.
Walter McManus, how do you describe the scale of the stakes here? The whole country has watched as the housing market's gone kaput. Outfits as big as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in big trouble. What are the stakes for GM, for Ford? I mean, are they at risk of going away?
Well, I think the plan that GM is following right now is, everything but in name bankruptcy. I mean, the slashing, the cutting, or suspending the dividend, the cutting of the salaried benefits. Like you said, they're spending $1 billion when they're taking in every month, and that is clearly not sustainable for a long term. So, they're just now celebrating their 100th anniversary. It may be the only centennial they hit. I mean, clearly, but they might not make another few years.
It's been most of your career, Walter. I mean, are you scratching your head and thinking about an America without big automakers?
Well, yes. I mean, I've lived in Detroit for 20 years, and Bill kind of said it. There's a state of denial. And it wasn't just GM. I mean, I think Ford had it, maybe not as bad, but and Chrysler, the denial that the good times are going to stop. And they Bill said. I mean, we propped up the sales of the SUVs, keep the plants running. At a time when we did that, it was 2001. You may not remember, but October 2001 was the number one sales month ever in the history of the industry.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about U.S. auto companies in crisis and whether and how they can be reborn, whether and how they might survive the centennial this week, the 100th anniversary of the founding of GM, of the rollout of Ford's Model T, but not a whole lot of cheering in that part of the world, and epic losses underway. We're joined by Walter McManus from San Jose, California today. He's Director of Automotive Analysis at the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute. And with us from Lexington, Virginia, David McGee, author and auto analyst, author of How Toyota Became Number One and Turnaround. Walter, David, we want to hear what their strategies are for coming out of this because, of course, we hope they do. But let's hear from our listeners for just a second in Nashville, Tennessee. Glenn, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
We have to remember that we've been through this before in the 1970s with the advent of Japanese imports and some poorly engineered responses from Detroit. I don't know why over the ensuing 30 years we've seen such a return to fuel-inefficient cars.
When you say we've been through it before, Glenn, does that mean you think they'll come through this one? It's going to be okay?
Well, no, I didn't see that. We got through it okay the last time. The Pinto, the Vega, Pacer, other terrible cars were the response from Detroit. And I don't know what it will take for them to actually be able to do some really good engineering. I know the people are there who can respond to this, but
we'll look at what it might take. And thanks for that call from Nashville. Let's go to Iowa and Danielle. Danielle, you're on the air.
Bring back the Ford Escort. I have one in my driveway. It has 200,000 miles on it. When I don't use that awful corn-based ethanol fuel, which is degrading Iowa's environment, by the way, I can get about 42 to 46 miles a gallon. Ford already has that mothballed.
Did you miss the 1990s memo, Danielle? You were supposed to be buying a big SUV.
No. I'm also a tree hugger, so I do not like SUVs. I love seeing them sitting on the side of the road with for sale signs on it. And the fuel crisis that is being suggested is not a crisis. It's not a crisis when you know it's coming. We've had two or three decades to get ready for this. We've just chosen not to do anything.
Bring back the Escort. Maybe they'll bring something like it. We'll ask Walter and David. Let's get a call from Boise, Idaho. And Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on your previous guest's information that the big three automakers were making as much as $15,000 per SUV and large truck.
Amazing, huh?
Yeah, and I just really hope that since these big three are already making profits basically on the consumer, that they don't end up turning to the taxpayer and the consumer again due to mismanagement for a bailout and let us pay not just record profits, but also pay for their, you know, their saving.
Yeah, and with the way things have been going, I mean, no one can blame you for wondering if that might be down the road. Let us look at all this. David McGee, first to you, on the question of, you know, Danielle in Iowa says she wants something like her Ford Escort back. Ford is saying it's going to bring its European models to the U.S. It's going to make them here. Are we going to see a company that gets in tune with smaller, fuel-efficient cars and maybe rides to a comeback on that wave?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question. I love her point, which is so valid, which, you know, Ford had these cars like the Escort, and we all know they had the Taurus. Well, the engineers charged with restyling those in the 90s carried about as much clout. You know, they were like back in the woodshed somewhere while the big truck and SUV designers were whining and dining, you know, with the executives because, you know, they had the pieces in their hand and they didn't update them. They didn't freshen them very well. They just kind of let them die and then killed them. And I love her point because they had them. Well, the good news is, as Alan Mulally knows, instinctively, they do have a good footprint and some good products in Europe, and that's a very savvy move for him to bring these here. Listen, Ford is not going away. They are going to adapt. But we are going to see a much, much smaller Ford. To the point earlier, you know, what we've got to understand is when we had the oil shock of the 1970s, the U.S. automakers were able to hang on because the foreign companies barely had a footprint here. And so we were worried. Everybody was worried about the dent they were making, but it was so small.
Right.
They've got a huge footprint now, Honda, Toyota. So it's going to be different.
They can turn out 4 million cars, foreign automakers, in this country right now. Walter McManus, we talked with a big Wall Street analyst yesterday. He looked at what's coming in Ford announcement and said it's too late in the game to catch up. It's just a matter of how they crash and burn, that the time and effort they need to put into retooling, while they're doing that, their competitors are moving on down the road. I mean, does this work practically, Walter?
Well, all of the companies are trying to switch to away from trucks to cars. Even Honda, that you know, their trucks are not really trucks. They're cars, but they're switching. And so the whole industry is trying to do this. It's just, you know, Ford was sort of the first one to be so heavily into the SUVs and pickups, and they've got the furthest to come back. And Chrysler probably next, and then GM. So, you know, Toyota's kind of facing problems, too, because of the trucks that they did. And their trucks are being unsold. And you know, so one of your callers mentioned we had signals about this for several years, at least in profit in the prices of the vehicles,
mm-hmm.
what they had to do, the used market. I mean, I track all this stuff. I wrote about it. I talked to people, but
the used market meaning nobody wanted to buy those low mileage SUVs on the used lots.
The value was falling rapidly, while every time they put an incentive on the new truck,
mm-hmm.
about the same amount of money comes off at the auction. It's a simple market. The new market, they put incentives, the used market clears. And so they put their customers upside down. You know, they don't have enough to trade in to get another one.
Right.
And they were still saying, you know, in 2004 or 5 that, you know, you're not going to trade in an SUV for a car just because it costs you $35 more a month.
You're going to stick with the bigger SUV, but can you blame them? I mean, when you look at the numbers, Toyota Prius, everybody's talking about hybrids now. It's the big name there, but it's only got, I think, something like 3% of the market, 91,000 units compared
they
to...
They sell more than Buick sells in total.
Well, okay, but the Ford F-Series, the pickup truck, 274,000, you know...
The pickup trucks used to be the number one and two vehicles. No longer, it's Honda and Toyota cars that have the number one, two, through four vehicles. The change happened so suddenly that it's mind-boggling to Detroit.
David, what about our caller's fear that this will turn into a taxpayer bailout? Does Detroit talk about that?
Yeah, well, listen, I think the point was made earlier that the current management of GM, at least, I think will get out of there before they do something so drastic. And I do think they're in that position to do it now, but I think they're going to do everything to avoid it. This is a red, white, and blue American company that understands. I mean, Rick Wagner is very smart.
CEO of GM, yep.
The CEO of GM, he understands the public relations debacle from that, and I think the point was made very well that effectively they're in a bankruptcy play now, and that's why you've seen their stock bounce back, because they finally took the steps with the dividend and the cuts and the changes that people have been wondering, what are you waiting on for the longest time? And, you know, 3 years ago I was at the auto show in Detroit, and we were kind of looking over at GM's, what they were showing their future wares, and they've got all these SUVs on the front row, and people were just going, you know, I think they're missing the future here. Well, they're not in denial about the future anymore. I think it's just a little bit late, and it's making it much more difficult to catch up.
Let's go to Mark in Grinnell, Iowa. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, your panelists already mentioned Honda and Toyota, and my question was, Honda and Toyota have been building quality products for many years. They seem to rival what Americans produce. Why can't the Americans keep up with that? Why it doesn't seem to be wages and so on. What's the issue? Why can't Americans keep up?
Boy, that's the question that's been out there since, what, maybe the late 70s now. Certainly the 80s, Walter McManus, is not just hybrid cars. I mean, people talking about American manufacturers lagging in multi-speed automatic transmissions, in sophisticated overhead cam motors, in quality small cars overall. It's such a big question, but is there an answer? The Asian companies have gone from strength to strength. Why, over all this time, can't Detroit?
Well, they have, but it's in SUVs. I mean, they're the best and the brightest, and it's actually wasn't the best and brightest. It was the lucky ones who were truck engineers, like Bill said. They were wined and dined by the executives and they reinvented things that we already had on cars, like rear doors. I mean, that cost a lot to reinvent the door.
What do you mean they reinvented the rear door? I missed that revolution.
We have four doors on a lot of cars.
Yeah.
Trucks always had two. I mean,
the little jump seats in the back there. But was it brilliance, or was it just driving a pickup truck through holes in the emissions regulations that let trucks go?
A lot of it was that. That's exactly. And I wanted to mention that, you know, despite the fact that they're making all these changes, they're still lobbying against California emission standards, and they're lobbying against CAFE. And it's, you know, their focus is still to try and blame the government.
You're in California right now, Walter, at this Plug-in 2008 conference on electric cars. GM talking a lot about this week, wanting electric grid operators to kind of up their capacity so they could have a whole lot of cars plugging in soon. Is that just happy talk, or might that be a solution, the sort of miracle way out of this pinch?
Well, I think it's a great idea. I'm not sure that Detroit can execute it. I mean, Detroit is good at the great American road, the great American car, the SUV, Mustang, the Camaro, but
the dream.
And this, I mean, the plug-in hybrid is a dream, but it's a geeky dream. It's the dream of the guys out here. I mean, I it's so funny. I was reading the paper this morning, and they're worried about, jobs, health.
Yeah.
And there's Steve Jobs. And Grove spoke at this conference.
Intel's Andy Grove. Yep.
Right. And I said, it's the hometown businesses. And because, everyone in Detroit thinks on a first-name basis with Rick Wagner. Mm. And it's, those companies out here, I mean, they've got, Intel is 130, well, more, you know, billions of dollars, 130 billion. Mm. GM and Ford combined are maybe $20 billion market cap.
Mm-hmm.
They should just do it here.
I mean, do it in Silicon Valley. Forget Detroit.
Yeah, I mean, because Detroit, see, I don't think Detroit understands the concept or the romance of the plug-in. I mean, they see it as fuel economy is all about utilitarianism and cost and benefits, and it doesn't make sense, but people buy them. And
they need to plug into the new dream, and maybe that grows out of a different soil. David McGee, how about it? Do you think that the American public, the American car-buying public, is plugging in, is buying into a new dream, what Walter calls a geeky dream here, the high-mileage, hybrid plug-in? You know, will that have the same romance and punch that Mustangs and Camaros and Lincoln Navigators did?
You know, I'm seeing people are certainly, you know, they're on it now because gas is getting their attention. I think he makes some great points. For starters, let's talk about, you know, GM's plug-in, pure plug-in. They're pushing the Volt. You know, I think this is going to be a great product if they get it out in 2010, as they're saying, and if it's affordable, like they're saying.
This is the very sporty, jazzy-looking electric car that I've seen might cost $40,000 a pop.
Right, and you go 40 miles on it. Okay, number one, they're going to have trouble making money on it. It's going to be a good PR gimmick. Number two, how many can they sell and make? Number three, this is not Apple with the iPod. I mean, this is a big, cumbersome company. You know, it's not like Apple when they spun out the iPod that all of a sudden they can sell millions of these things.
Send some specs off to Malaysia and they come back on the next plane, yeah.
Sure, the company is not that nimble. Let's not miss the point. I'm kind of weary of hearing this as some kind of silver bullet. It's a step. It's nothing more than a step and an important one, and you know, more to follow, but it's not going to be a silver bullet. They ignored hybrids as well as several other companies. Nissan was behind the curve on the hybrids for the longest time, and you know, these companies are paying the price now. People are looking for a step forward. They don't need a full jump, a full leap forward right now. They're saying they're willing to take a step forward, and hybrids are the first answer there.
They sure need a step. Let's go to Maura in Holliston, Massachusetts. Maura, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sitting here in my Prius, which I waited 6 weeks for.
Okay.
After 3 years ago calling Ford when we wanted to trade in our 8-year-old Taurus, and they had nothing on the books. And then the only option was to buy the Ford Escape SUV, and now I can buy, a Yukon hybrid, mm-hmm. which the mileage is sad. I didn't have any chance for a tax credit on this car because Toyota already has 60,000 hybrids on the road, yet I could buy a Yukon and get only slightly better mileage than the actual Yukon and get a $3,000 tax credit. So they've built this. They've built themselves into a corner with this. They have the hybrid technology. I've been averaging 50 miles a gallon. So why aren't they looking at what they already have?
You're averaging that with your Prius, Maura.
With my Prius,
yep.
You know, a lot of highway, a lot of round town with the kids.
Yep.
It's not a compact. It's a full 5-passenger car with more legroom than our old sedan.
Hmm.
And, you know, it's there, and they're not embracing it. And everybody I know is on the list for a Prius now, and now there's like a 4-month wait for it. So they have their head in the sands for all those years. Ford retooled that factory that was a big brownfield nightmare into one of the biggest LEED certified buildings in the country. And yet they didn't have their eye on the future with the cars.
Okay. I mean, so the question is why? I guess part of the answer is that a whole lot of your fellow Americans bought those big SUVs and pickup trucks and were very happy to have them. Gave $15,000 per unit profit back to the maker for the full-size ones. Maura, thanks for your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking about U.S. auto companies in crisis and whether and how they can be reborn, whether and how they can survive. We've been joined by Walter McManus of the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute, by David McGee, author and auto analyst, author of How Toyota Became Number One in Turnaround, and right now from Lexington, Massachusetts, by John Wolkonowicz, senior analyst and forecaster for the auto industry at Global Insights, research and consulting firm. He's worked for both GM and Ford as a product planner and maybe sees a little more sunshine coming up. We'd like to hear that. John, thanks very much for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
desperate times, says Bill Vlasic with the New York Times covering Detroit, and we've heard a lot of that. Do you see a way out of the hole that these companies are in? What would it look like?
Well, the potential way out is to build the kinds of products consumers want to buy. That's always been the key to success in the auto industry. And actually, it's one of the ways that Detroit got themselves into the situation that they're in today.
But didn't they do that in the 80s and 90s with the SUV? And here
we
are.
That's exactly what they did. They built what consumers wanted to buy. You know, if you go back to the 70s, a lot of younger consumers got turned off with U.S.-made cars. You know, the Vega and the Pinto were mentioned earlier.
Yep.
These are the people that went Toyota, Honda, Nissan. The older people kept buying the American cars, but they've now pretty much died out of the market. But interestingly enough, well, the baby boomer and younger generations bought Japanese and European cars. They bought American SUVs as well. This was the savior of Detroit in the 90s into the first part of this decade.
But the savior dug a hole where, you know, now they've got low mileage, big vehicles when those aren't selling at all.
It sure did. But unfortunately, in the auto industry, you have a 5-year product development lead time to go from concept to customer. You know, this 2011 Focus that's gotten a lot of press lately that Ford will be bringing to market in calendar year 2010.
Okay.
We've had that on our forward planning books now for 2 years. That's not a new program at Ford. They've been trying to pull it ahead a bit as the need has developed.
But do the numbers add up, I guess, John, is the question. They're burning billions, you know, a billion a month or more in a single company. I mean, can they hang in there and retool and still be in one piece and ready to serve that customer in 2010, 2011, 2015?
Well, that's what the restructurings that are being announced and have been announced recently are all about. And that's all up to, really, the trajectory of the American economy. Right now, our economists are forecasting an uptick in the economy in 2010. And I think a lot of economists are doing the same thing. So right now, as the auto companies are looking at this, they've got to jump over this rather nasty puddle, if you will, in 08 and 09, and make it to 2010 when the economy improves, when their new products are hitting the market.
Boy, that sounds like it could be a long shot. David McGee, do you see them clearing the puddle? I mean, so many American jobs count on it. Such a piece, historically, of the American economy. Do you see them making it to the other side, David?
I mean, I see them making it. That's making it is in a reshaped form. As I said, GM was in denial for a lot longer period. Ford has been saying, Bill Ford Jr. was talking about a number of years ago, we're not going to look like the same company we were, and kind of effectively said we're willing to go there to do what it takes to protect this brand and stuff. So they've not, you know, they've had a hard time getting there, and they're still having a hard time. But I think they'll be in a different shape. One key point here that I'm not hearing talked about much on the forefront. I don't mean on this forum.
Yep.
I mean just out there outside of Detroit and people looking in at the problems is a dirty little secret in Detroit for the longest time has been the aftermarket. They've effectively created this giant landfill of used cars, and the point was made earlier, every time they go slash the rebates, they're slashing the price on the aftermarket. They were artificially propping up from 2001 on, they were artificially propping up new car sales with just unreasonable incentives to make buyers make a purchase on what they did not want.
And you're saying what, that big inventory of used cars now leans against more new car sales?
Oh, it completely does. It used to not, because they would get so much incentive to go back. But what's happening is, let's take, say, a used SUV like a Tahoe, a Jeep Cherokee. I mean, there's a number of them. What's happening, what you're going to see is the price of those is falling so precipitously that once gas prices stabilize a little bit, so the buyer is going to go, you know, I am going to pay a little more for gas, but I can buy this thing for $10,000, and, man, it's in great shape. There is a mass glut of these cars in America. It's like we've created this giant landfill of them, and it's kind of Detroit's dirty little secret that is not being identified enough. Consumers are going to have a bigger option as we go forward. And that 14 million new car sales next year, they're predicting, it could get a little more slippery than they're thinking.
Well, yet another big escape hatch or highway for Americans who could buy those used SUVs so cheaply that they offset an awful lot of expensive gas. We may have a caller just on that point from Savannah, Tennessee. Yeah, Tennessee. Justin, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Pretty well. What do you know?
I've heard people talk bad about Ford and GM and all that good stuff, but I'm a loyal Ford buyer.
All right. We need them.
Super Crew. And I read where a study, I'm not sure when it was done, but it was done apparently here recently, where the Toyota Prius costs over a lifespan around $5 and some change per mile because those batteries only last about 100,000 miles, and it's $5,000 or $6,000 to replace the batteries, and then you got to pay, you know, the disposal fee on the batteries. Where Ford and GM don't have that expense. I know my F-150, I read it costs $3.67 per mile over a lifespan to operate that vehicle. Yeah, that seems kind of high, but, you know, it's going to last me. My 2002 F-150 has 210,000 miles on it, and it's never had a motor. It's not anywhere near needing a motor or a transmission.
Yep.
And my dealer says, you know, it could last me 400,000 miles if I wanted it to, or more than that.
So when you do the math, it still comes back to your F-150, to your pickup truck.
Right, yeah.
Walter McManus, how about it? You hear Justin there in Savannah saying, you know what, the bottom line still looks good for Ford to him as the consumer, you know, doing the math.
Well, I think he's a pickup truck driver, and that's a very loyal segment. I think, you know, it fits his need. I owned a pickup for a few months, and I could not figure out what to do with it.
But is he right on the math? There's loyalty, but he's saying,
on the math. Well, he's right on the math if the batteries fail. But they've never had a Toyota, one of the batteries in the Prius or the Honda batteries. They haven't failed yet. I mean, they've got, I don't know how many they have on the road, but they have never had a failure. So, I mean, yes, if it fails and you have to buy it, then we're talking about a big expense, but none of them have failed yet.
And so on they drive. Let's get a call from Canada, Ottawa, Canada, and Richard. Hi, Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Oh. Actually, I'm formerly of Boston, but I was kind of hoping that the conversation might take a step back, get a little bit of a broader view in a sense. When in 2000, my family, we were the second people to take delivery of the then very innovative Toyota Prius. And I remember asking one of the dealers, I lived out there in sort of Route 9 area near Natick and all that. And so I went into a Ford dealer, and I sort of was talking up the Prius, and I said, you know, how come it has to be a foreign company that does this and comes up with this fantastically interesting product? And the fellow kind of looked at me and he said, you know, in the United States, if you're a public company, you can't afford to take a risk like Toyota's doing. You know, they're investing, $4 billion or something, and they're hoping that in the long term they're going to make that money back. In America, you can't do that with your shareholders because you'll go to jail for losing or squandering shareholder equity in the short term, and Toyota is not encumbered in such a way. And I was sort of caught speechless. I thought, oh, my God, you mean it's the way we have companies set up that sort of eliminates the possibility of imaginative long-term thinking about what the consumer might want or how conditions might change. And let's be ready for it when it happens. You know, clearly GM, Ford, Chrysler, they haven't done it, maybe because they can't do it.
Richard, let us look at it there. Early adopter you are, getting that early Prius, but Detroit wasn't there for you. John Wolkonowicz, I mean, Toyota's publicly traded too, but in a different context, a different culture. You know, do we have some kind of structural problem around these companies that prohibits them, or is it more the entropy, lethargy, quick sale, you know, low strategic awareness. I don't know.
Now, we tend to have a 30-day mentality that's driven by Wall Street in this country. I'm afraid I do agree with the caller. Every program that gets approved at an American auto company has to have a very positive financial forecast connected to it. And if you go back to, well, if you go back 4 years ago or 5 years ago to 2003, when you'd have to have started planning a vehicle that would be introduced today, it would be very difficult for a GM, Ford, or a Chrysler to justify the development money to do a Prius. Because the sales, you know, you looked at the sales of the existing Prius, they were tiny at that time. That wasn't what the majority of American buyers wanted to buy. And I'm afraid that's what they had to provide. So the decision, for example, at GM at that time was made to do a next generation full-size SUV.
But something is wrong with this picture, John. We've got too big of problems in this country now to let that go on, if that's the inhibitor on the kind of change to keep people employed, to keep companies profitable. I mean, that just, we can't have that.
I agree with you, but unfortunately, Detroit lives by Wall Street, by the price of the stock, by how the Wall Street analysts see that company at that particular moment in time. They're not looking ahead at where will Ford or GM be 15 years from now. They're looking, Wall Street is looking at what's the next quarter's profitability going to be. And really, the companies have to be managed to maximize that. It's a very unfortunate situation.
Let's take a call from Ravenel, South Carolina, and Ann. Hi, Ann. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to kind of step out of the box a little bit with the car companies for what I could see as a possible solution. You know, Bill Gates recently stepped down. I think he could use something new to focus all that talent and energy on, and maybe he could just put a fuel-efficient car in every garage as he did with computers in almost every home. And I'll take my answer off the air.
And I love it. Bill Gates has got a little time on his hands. Let's get him in the driver's seat. Walter, you're out in high-tech land in California this week. I mean, you yourself said maybe move the whole thing to California. Are you serious? Do we need that kind of revolution? A Gates, a Jobs at the helm?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it is. It's the dream of the folks out here. It's not Detroit's dream. And so, yeah, I think, and I don't know if Gates may not be geeky enough anymore. He's too rich to be a geek.
He's a philanthropist now.
Yes. But, you know, one of the things we keep talking about these being American companies, but, and, you know, they can't build things in China and bring them here. Well, they're starting to, and they're going to see if they can do that more and more. In fact, it's not going to be too many years when GM will make more vehicles in China than they make in the U.S. or even North America. And are they an American company when they make more cars in China than here? So, you know, I think some of the loyalty to the company because they're incorporated in Delaware is misplaced. They're multinational corporations.
David, how do you see it? Could it be that we're on the verge of such a transportation revolution with an energy crisis and people working hard on new technologies that the whole U.S. industry might just up and move its locus to maybe a more creative, maybe a more nimble leadership part of the country?
I think that it's going to be, you know, dictated out of both talent and necessity. I think we cannot look for the engineering solutions to come totally from Detroit anymore, because as you move away more and more from mainstream typical automotive, obviously your solutions will have to come from other places. But, you know, one of the points was made earlier, which I must say, the backbone. First of all, I'm not I'm a Ford guy, like I'm a Chrysler guy and a GM guy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an American. I'm pulling for them. But, you know, in that book, How Toyota Became Number One, I wrote, it was exactly what the caller a minute ago was saying. The whole book, what I found is the difference in Toyota largely has been a much more long-term outlook. There's other factors, and many of them are debatable, but that has really been a backbone of this company. Now, fortunately, we're saying, well, the Americans aren't doing it. Actually, GM with the Volt is exactly doing it. That's a product that I'm not sure the profitability is right in the, you know, rearview mirror, yet they are doing it. So we do have some of that on the horizon, and I feel very good about it. I'm just not sure it's the savior to save, the, you know, the sword, silver sword to save the company tomorrow. But we are finally seeing that. But that has clearly been the problem, is Wall Street dictating and the companies following in America. We have to break this cycle of short-term business view in America, or we are really going to pay a price. We have to have long-term investment. You know, we talk about the Silicon Valley deal. Well, they're kind of like the Henry Fords of yesterday. They're afforded to do that. Detroit doesn't have that luxury, and so they're going to have to go outside and find it.
John, what do you think? We're going to break the cycle of short-term thinking here? Will emergency necessity be the mother of some kind of new American invention a century after the Model T rolled off the line?
Yeah, you know, there's a belief, kind of a commonly held belief, that nothing important gets done unless it's done in response to a crisis. And I think we have that crisis right now. And I think, you know, vehicles like the Volt, as David just mentioned, are a response to that crisis. So the kind of thing that would have been financially impossible to do in Detroit just 5 years ago. So, yeah, I think I'm hoping certainly that this is the impetus needed to turn this whole situation around. And I think there's an awfully good chance that it is.
Well, maybe we're staring at that moment right now. I want to thank each of you for being with us. John Wolkonowicz at Global Insights in Lexington, Massachusetts. John, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
David McGee in Lexington, Virginia, author of How Toyota Became Number One. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Walter McManus, joining us today from San Jose, California, director of the Automotive Analysis at the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute. Walter, thank you very much for your time and thoughts.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.